From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, a stringent new abortion law in Georgia could threaten the state's $9 billion film and TV industry as Hollywood considers boycotting the state. Then Jonathan Van Ness, best known from the series Queer Eye, explains the creative process behind his Game of Thrones recap show, Gay of Thrones.
There is some yelling at the screen, usually for me, but we turn the lights off, we have snacks, and we write. There's a lot of typing.
And we'll meet the singer who's known as the Cuban James Brown. All that coming up on The Frame. Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. In recent years, Georgia has become a favorite out-of-state location for Hollywood, and that may now be in question. Today, the state's governor, Brian Kemp, signed one of the most restrictive abortion laws in the nation. It is set to be enforced at the start of next year. The so-called fetal heartbeat bill essentially bans abortions after women are just 6 weeks pregnant. It will likely be challenged in court. Hollywood's economic impact in Georgia is estimated at more than $9 billion. Current and recent productions there include the FX series Atlanta, the Marvel movie Black Panther, and the upcoming horror film Annabelle 3. While the state's abortion bill was being debated, producers and actors threatened to boycott Georgia if it became law. To hear more about how the anti-abortion law has divided the state and threatens Georgia's movie and TV business, I called up Jim Galloway. He's a political reporter with the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, and we started with a statement made by actress Alyssa Milano last month in front of Georgia's House of Representatives.
We want to stay in Georgia. We want to continue to support the wonderful people and the wonderful businesses and communities we have come to love in the Peach State. But we will not do so silently, and we will do everything in our power to move our industry to a safer state for women if HB 481 becomes the law.
What was she talking about, and what has the industry said it might do?
Well, here's the situation. She came April 2nd, I believe, and she had a good many followers walk into the governor's office and hand him a letter threatening a boycott of the state if 481 was passed. And this is the key to understanding the situation, is that not a single Democrat showed up beside with her.
So there are a couple things that are at issue here. One is the economic impact that film work has in the state. By some estimates, it's $9 billion. Marvel makes a lot of movies there. There's a lot of television production there as well. So how important is film production, even with some incentives that the state might be giving these productions, to the state's economy?
It's become extremely important, and it's going to get more so, especially in our technical colleges. You've seen them readjust the curriculum to include full degrees in stagehand technology, lighting, electricians, and it's already affected the political waters in Georgia.
You mentioned how there are no Democrats who are visibly supporting Alyssa Milano when she presented her argument to the governor. What are the Democrats' concerns here, and how does it involve the state's union rules?
The first thing you have to realize is Georgia is a right-to-work state. It is very, very hard for unions to establish themselves. And yet, Yahtzee Local 479 has just exploded since 2005, when the tax credits for the movie and TV industry began. It started then, I think they had maybe 250 workers in the union. Now they've got more than 5,000. And you've got a like number of Teamsters involved in the movie industry. And in Georgia, while they don't make up a large part of the workforce, they are a crucial part of the Democratic political operation when it comes to national contacts, when it comes to early money, and when it comes to organization on election day.
Let's talk about some of the reactions to the governor signing the bill. I spoke with a filmmaker and an actor this morning, and both said, in so many words, they will not come to work in Georgia as long as this bill is on the books. And I suspect you might be hearing from other people who are saying the same. And you spoke with Patrick Millsaps, who is a producer and CEO of Londonderry, which is a Georgia-based production company. And he says that a boycott would actually be, I think his words were, disrespectful. What is his argument, and what is he advocating?
His argument is primarily that Hollywood has enough Me Too problems of its own, that it has treated women poorly enough that maybe it shouldn't be coming into Georgia and claiming the high ground. That's number one. And number two, he's saying it disrespects the actual size and effort of the industry right now in Georgia.
So the woman who lost to the governor, Stacey Abrams, also said that she is afraid that Georgians who work on film crews and make a living here will suffer and they're not to blame. So it feels as if even people who are opposed to the bill, they have very mixed feelings about its impact on the state's film economy if there is a boycott.
Right, right. Oh, yes, absolutely. But what I think we're going to be watching from here in Georgia, we will be watching, number one, union leadership here and what they say. And I want to hear what studio heads have to say, because they will make the final decisions on whether a production comes into the state and stays in the state. I don't know whether an actual boycott will jump up here, though.
Before the bill's passage, outside of actors like Alyssa Milano, were Hollywood studios lobbying against the bill in any way? Were they visibly out and against it?
Yes, they were lobbying, not publicly, privately. They were begging Republicans not to pass this sucker.
But it does sound like the bill that Governor Kemp signed will become law in the new year. And it feels like, based on what I know, there's very little chance that he is going to change his mind.
Oh, no. He's already signed the bill. It's part of the Georgia statutes. But the ACLU is all this. You have to remember, this is happening in about six other states. Pretty much the same legislation with slight variations is happening and the whole object is to get it to the Supreme Court. So the first thing that's going to happen with this law is the ACLU down here in Atlanta has already got a lawsuit ready to file, and it will go before a federal judge, and the federal judge will put this in the cooler until the constitutional issues are argued out.
Jim Galloway is a political reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, and he joined us from Atlanta. Jim, thanks for getting on the phone.
I enjoyed it greatly. Thank you.
Coming up, a Game of Thrones recap show that you can enjoy even if you're not a fan of the HBO series. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. You've certainly heard of Game of Thrones, the HBO series that is now in its eighth and final season. But what about Gay of Thrones? Gay of Thrones is a funny or die web series that's been recapping Game of Thrones episodes ever since season three. The show is hosted by Jonathan Van Ness. You might know him as the hairstylist and grooming expert on the Netflix show Queer Eye. Each week, a different guest, like Gabrielle Union or Anna Faris, sits down in Jonathan's stylist chair for a pretend haircut, and the two get talking about that weekend's episode of Game of Thrones with countless jokes and pop culture references. Here's a clip from today's episode with actor and comedian Kumail Nanjiani about a pivotal Game of Thrones scene between Cersei and Tyrion Lannister.
I beg you.
But evil no-volume Carol Brady goes,
no dice!
She's like, don't you dare use my maternal instincts against me. I am just as vindictive and unreasonable as any man.
That was recorded just yesterday at the Funny or Die Studios in Hollywood, where I visited to chat with Jonathan Van Ness and Aaron Gibson, the series creator and director.
She's like, don't you dare use my maternal instincts against me. I'm as vindictive and unreasonable as any man.
Yes. She's like, don't you dare use my maternal instincts against me. I am just as vindictive and unreasonable as any man.
Great. Okay,
when I sat down with Aaron Gibson and Jonathan Van Ness after the shoot, I asked Van Ness how making time for Game of Thrones works logistically with all his commitments for Queer Eye.
Season 7, which was the last season, I was in Atlanta shooting Queer Eye. So I would shoot Queer Eye Tuesday through Friday and then get on a plane and then come here, do Game of Thrones, get back on the plane, go back to Atlanta. And now this time, I have since moved to New York. And so Sunday mornings, I get up and I pop on a plane and I get here. And then I come watch a show with everyone. And then I go home. And, well, then I pitch all my jokes before everyone else gets to pitch their jokes, which is really nice of me. So, you know, then everyone else gets to stay up till midnight. And then I tap out at 9. I'm like, oh, my God, I'm so tired. Which I say is a joke, but really I am. It's a lot. Like,
you have to go to sleep. We need you to be amazing on camera.
She does. You need to go to bed.
What is it like when you guys are watching it? Is it like being in a theater where everybody's talking back to the screen? Like there's just constant banter? Are you making notes? What does it sound like?
This year we have like a new method where we're doing like one of our people like will yell out the scene number. So it's like scene one, scene two. So because we're all kind of writing like while we're watching it. So there is some yelling at the screen, usually for me, but we turn the lights off. We have snacks and we write. We really are. There's a lot of typing.
Our other tradition is that we always have tender greens. We've had tender greens every single year.
For
and shockingly, we're not sick of it.
Not sick of it.
There are so many recaps of Game of Thrones. And what's amazing to me is how quick and how thorough they are. And when you were thinking about how you were going to both recap an episode and then do something that's funny, how do you figure out what is first? Because is it important that you get the story right first and then add the jokes, or what order do they come in?
I think it's always about serving the purpose of how Jonathan has regurgitated the show. So in my mind, it's always funny first, but I do want this to be a cheat sheet for people who maybe don't watch Game of Thrones and maybe want to not feel like they're an outcast in society at work. So they do know what's going on. But first and foremost, it's about making this show funny and allowing Jonathan to shine his very specific and hilarious light on a show that is the most macabre thing on TV.
The other thing that you guys seem to be really intentional about is making sure that you have the most latest pop culture references possible. So you just did an episode where you have a Mayor Pete reference. There's a reference to the Boeing 737 MAX. Is it always like what happened that day that we can incorporate? How do you think about what is and is not funny or worth including?
Well, I have to say, you know, in the episode from last week, you know, it was all about Martina Hingis.
This battle had more ups and downs than Martina Hingis's storied tennis career. So first, things are going great. She wins the Australian Open in 97.
Well, then she screws up the French Open by serving underhanded to Steffi Graf and gets booed off the court.
But then she goes on to slay at Wimbledon.
Unfortunately, then she tests positive for snow, which she denies.
That's what I love about our writing room is that, like, it's really, we're gonna get niche. We're gonna go big. We're gonna go niche. We're gonna go now. We're gonna go 86. We're gonna go 94. You don't know. Also, we might have a Revolutionary War thing. Like, you just don't know what you're gonna get.
Last night, we cut a joke because we couldn't remember if we had already made it. And it was a Notting Hill reference. And it was, I'm just a dragon queen standing in front of a murderess asking her to surrender.
So how does the Martina Hingis reference come in? Because it goes on for like 2 minutes. It's all of Martina's tennis career, the ups and downs. I forgot that she gotten popped for a drug offense. And it's like there is a lot of research and detail in your Martina Hingis story.
Well, what happened there was, as Aaron was trying to figure out a great analogy for something that has a lot of ups and downs. And
we wanted to get through the battle scenes quickly because it was just a lot of carnage.
It was a lot of carnage. And I just, all the ideas that were coming up for something that had a lot of ups and downs just weren't feeling quite on the Game of Thrones brand when all of a sudden, Martina Hingis's underhand serve to Steffi Graf in the 99 French Open just leaped into my head. And I was like, oh my God. It's Martina Hingis's tennis career, which when anything sounds like, oh my God, it's Martina Hingis's tennis career, you know, adjacent to the Battle of Winterfell, I think it's just great comedy. You know it's going to be good.
When you are looking at an episode like last night, do you look to see how other people are joking about something and make sure that you're doing something different?
I think by default of just, you know, what this show is, we are already doing something different, but I additionally want to have safety nets in place by looking on Twitter, seeing what everyone's talking about. Like, for example, the coffee cup. This morning, everyone was talking about the coffee cup. So how can we do it in a way where we're not actually, like, directly saying it, but, like, winking at it? So, like, we had, spoiler alert, we had placed different coffee cups in our set, but we never, like, mentioned it, you know? We were trying to play it a little bit cooler. And so where does that stuff fall that we want to talk about that we think is important, but not say the same things that all the other jokes that are being made on Twitter, because they're being made instantly while people are watching, and we don't want it. We want to make sure that we're serving a different audience and a different type of joke.
And also, I feel like sometimes when we all get on set, like magic will happen occasionally from like some improv on set, or like when our guest comes in with a specific experience or like something they want to add, we get a lot of funny stuff like that too, like from the people who we get to work with.
Oh, like last week with Gabrielle making a Color Purple joke. That wasn't in the script. That was just her coming in and just bringing more magic to the show.
Poor Theon. I hope him and his get reunited in heaven. Oh my God, it's gonna be like when Nettie and Celie get reunited in Color Purple.
Nothing will keep me from you.
And I can't wait.
We're talking with Jonathan Van Ness and Aaron Gibson about Game of Thrones. This all started in a barber's chair. Or do we call it a salon chair?
It's a salon chair.
I'm sorry. It's all started in a salon chair.
I couldn't recline that chair to shave Aaron's face or neck, you know?
And I'm very hairy.
How is the haircut?
Well, Jonathan's been doing my hair for almost 10 years. I met you in 2008.
No, because I moved here in 9.
Okay, so it must have been at 9, though.
I met you in the end of 9. By early 2010, I was like, what's the haps?
I was dyeing my own hair and you were like, what are you doing?
Yep. There was a little situation going on when I took her back to the shampoo bowl to get her ready for my boss. And I was like, oh my God, what's the tea?
And that's when this all happened, because I was working at Funny or Die as a writer director. And I was at that point the only female on staff. And I was in the chair with Jonathan. He was recapping Game of Thrones to another stylist client. And he kept calling Robert Baratheon she. And I just thought, this is really funny. So I went into Funny or Die and I was like, hey, I have a off-the-wall pitch. Can I bring my hairdresser who's never been on camera in here to recap this show? And literally, this is the kind of place where they're just like, all right. So we did it.
Jonathan, how important has Game of Thrones been to you? Because you're still doing it, even though obviously since that first pitch, a lot has changed in your life.
Yeah, Game of Thrones is like so major to me, but really, like, Game of Thrones was my first time. When Erin said that, I thought she meant like on a phone. I had never really been like on a set, so I didn't understand like what we were really getting into. And then we have like, I mean, Erin and I have done this for 53 episodes together. Matt Mazzani, our executive producer, has been on this for 53 episodes, and he was our first guest in the chair for the first episode ever. And so there are people that, you know, have been on this show. Our core people have been on this show together since 2013. So it's like, not only do I have like personal relationships with them and look forward to getting to work with them and write with them and create together, we've created this like little magical baby together who people really like to get together and see. And it's just so fun to do. And I feel like every other way that my life has changed, which I knew I wanted to do hair when I was like a 4-year-old kid. And I always just wanted to be a successful hairdresser who didn't need to borrow money from anyone to cover my rent and like just wanted to like breathe. And when I started making stuff on camera with Aaron, I, you know, got bit by a severe case of that I want to keep making content bug. And my life has changed so much, but I would not have experienced like any of the changes that my life has experienced if it wasn't for my friendship with Aaron and if it wasn't for her seeing a potential in me that I never knew that I had. So I wouldn't be where I am in any way if it wasn't for Game of Thrones. So there was no way I wasn't going to finish it out and come see my friends and get to make this, finish what we started, you know?
But it was so obvious from the minute you were talking in that chair to me, like, that you were meant to do this. Like, I wouldn't just put someone in a chair on camera if I didn't think that you had it in you to do it. You know what I mean? It wasn't like some like weird experiment where I was like, let's see if this is a failure. I was like, this is going to work because you're involved.
But that's why I say that she is like the usher to my Justin Bieber, because she really did like discovered me to me. Like, I didn't even know that I could do any of the things that I've done. And she was like the first person. I was like, oh, like that queen's got potential. I didn't know.
Jonathan and Aaron, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah. Oh,
That was Jonathan Van Ness and Aaron Gibson, executive producers of the web series Game of Thrones on Funny or Die. Episodes go up Tuesday on YouTube and on funnyordie.com. Coming up, a singer from Havana who's known as the Cuban James Brown. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. U.S.-Cuba relations appear to be reverting to the Cold War era. Last month, the Trump administration announced a new Cuban policy reversing the changes President Obama put in place 5 years ago. Among the new changes are restrictions on travel to Cuba by U.S. citizens. And Cubans who want to visit the U.S. have to travel to a third country in order to apply for visas. But that didn't prevent a recent visit to L.A. by Sima Funk, the singer whom Billboard magazine named one of the top 10 Latin artists to watch in 2019. The Frame contributor Beto Arco spent some time with a singer who's called the Cuban James Brown.
It's a Friday night at the no-name restaurant and bar on Fairfax. The place is packed with a couple hundred people as Sima Funk and his seven-piece band deliver a blistering set of dance music. Sima Funk is the brainchild of 30-year-old Eric Iglesias, a self-taught singer who moved to Havana 8 years ago from the province of Pinar del Río. Iglesias did not attend Cuba's renowned music schools, and he doesn't come from a musical family. But he grew up absorbing a wide range of music, especially American pop, which he heard on cassettes in the family car.
Every time that I could, I get into the car and I put a cassette, and I just literally I kill the battery of the car, just listen music like Lionel Richie and Michael Jackson with the album Invisible. It's one of my favorites. It's my favorite, actually. Stevie Wonder also.
Iglesias got his first break. He successfully auditioned to sing background vocals for pop singer Raul Paz. He began collaborating with different bands and projects. Iglesias joined Interactivo, a collective project with some of Cuba's most prominent alternative music figures, led by pianist Roberto Carcassés. During the time he was with Interactivo, Iglesias and a couple friends created a cover band called Los Boys, and he started to develop his own musical ideas.
Because I was crazy with the rhythm, so I say, man, I need to start to experiment how I can know this way to sing, this way to perform the groove. So I say, let's make a band. We only gonna do covers from Stevie and from Michael Jackson. Once we understand what is about this product that they have, then we pass to other stuff.
That was the plan, but instead, Los Boys started making all kinds of other music, like this one called What You Think. Los Boys got a contract to work for 8 months on a cruise ship in the Mediterranean. When the tour ended, Iglesias had saved enough money to buy the equipment he needed to record his first album, but he didn't have a name. He learned about the Cimarron culture, runaway slaves in Cuba who created their own communities and lived freely in the forest.
Black people from many places, from many tribes, from Nigeria, from many places of other countries, and all they was living together, you know, with different sounds, with different groove, with different rituals, with different, maybe different God even. And they all live together, and they have to live together because it was the only way to live without be a slave.
He called on some friends, and together they came up with the name Sima Funk, combining Cimarron and funk. Ya no sé qué hacer contigo. Sima Funk's manager is Argelio Rodriguez. He says the respected pianist Roberto Carcassés gave him some valuable feedback.
We were in a car, leaving a concert, and when he heard the record, he said, this is going to be a big thing. That's the first time I heard that.
Sima Funk has been touring the U.S. for the past 6 weeks, making stops in 16 cities, including South by Southwest in Austin, New York, Chicago, and New Orleans. But this is not a normal U.S. tour. I recently caught the band having lunch and jamming at San Julian Park in L.A.'s Skid Row, an area with a huge homeless population.
We always try and make everything two-way, so as much as we can bring Cubans and Cuban culture and thought leaders to the U.S., we do. So we bring a lot of entrepreneurs and cultural acts here.
That's Colin Laverty, the man behind Sima Funk's tour. Laverty is a leading expert on U.S.-Cuba relations. He runs Cuba Educational Travel, an organization that takes Americans to Cuba. During the tour, Laverty organized showcases for Google, YouTube, and Netflix. I asked him why he took Sima Funk to Skid Row, and he told me what the band said to him upon arriving.
You know, two nights ago we performed for Leonardo DiCaprio and Sylvester Stallone and a star-studded lineup on a $40 million mansion in Beverly Hills overlooking all of the city, and 2 days later we're here in Skid Row. And so I think in terms of getting a taste of America and understanding and also, you know, appreciating what they have.
On another night, Sima Funk took part in a Q&A and performance at the Grammy Museum. Moderator Scott Goldman asked Iglesias if he considered himself a renegade, changing the perception of Cuban music. Iglesias was candid.
No. It's not like this. I'm just recycling what is done already. You know, I not changed anything. I'm just doing things. I'm putting music style. I'm putting this way, this stuff. I'm putting together in a personal way.
After the Q&A, Sima Funk performed to an adoring audience that could not stop dancing. Colin Laverty says Sima Funk has the talent and the vision to become the biggest modern-day Cuban artist.
So he is going to be the face of Cuba. He's going to be the cultural ambassador of Cuba, and I think that serves a very important role in terms of allowing Americans to understand the talent, the kindness, and the warmth of the Cuban people, which he clearly represents.
Laverty says, for 60 years, we've been relying on governments to resolve U.S.-Cuba relations, and they haven't done a very good job. But he believes cultural exchange can continue to build bridges, especially with artists like Sima Funk. For The Frame, I'm Beto Arcos.
And that's our show for today. Remember, you can follow us on Twitter and Facebook. You can find us at The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. We're back here tomorrow. Puedo seguir pa' mi casa o puedo coger este ritmo. Dime que tú quieras ser pa', yo sabes que voy a...